Willem Middelkoop, author of The Big Reset and founder of the Commodity Discovery Fund. Welcome to The Competent Investor. Thanks for joining me.
Well, good to be back, Tom.
So, Willem, looking through my notes from the last time we spoke, we were talking about a peace deal being negotiated for the Ukraine. And now we're in a new war, a new cycle of conflict, pause, negotiate. What do you see right now as the best case scenario for markets and the world if peace was actually negotiated tomorrow, let's say? Has irreparable damage with lags been done to the energy and food supply chains?
For me, if we would have peace in Ukraine and a peace deal around Iran, I think the most significant change would be that compared to, let's say, pre-war in Iran and pre-Ukraine, the US has gambled and lost, especially if we look at the last conflict around Iran. Trump was, well, more or less pressured by Israel, by Netanyahu, to initiate this war. I think he gambled and he lost. He thought this would be an easy walkover, just like the one in Venezuela. Now he's trapped. But no matter what the outcome will be, I think the US lost a lot of support in the Middle East. The US lost a lot of their, let's say, military infrastructure in the Middle East. The UAE leaving OPEC is a great sign of, let's say, the secondary effects of this war. Mm-hmm. So from a geopolitical point of view, which actually is that's the point of view I like to focus on, you could say that China is a big winner without firing a shot. But the consequences of this conflict, it's way too early to say what the effects will be. But it's for sure the US lost a lot of its, well, importance from a geopolitical point of view, and China, I think, won in a large way. Mm-hmm.
So with the Strait of Hormuz being functionally closed, we see that this has, you know, back and forth put a lot of pressure on the oil price. Do you see this as a time where prices are not unbearable yet? Like, it seems like we are in a lag time of inventories being drawn down. What do you think is this, the period, or the, let's say, the price where it becomes unbearable, where countries don't have the ability to continue to absorb reduced output and relatively higher prices?
Well, of course, the markets need to find a new balance. And since production is down, let's say, 10% on average worldwide, yet 100 million of barrels production per day, that's around 90 now, or that's at least what's available to the market. You need demand destruction. And we haven't seen real demand destruction yet. You know, we have seen a few flight cancellations, but I think in the next few months, you can expect a higher oil price to reach that demand destruction. And I think you need to see oil prices north of $150 to get real demand destruction. So that's something to watch. I think markets are too relaxed now, given the fundamental outlook in energy markets and also for the broader economy. A worldwide recession is in the cards, given the high oil prices and the inflation, which will start to rise again. And I think this will be the second wave of inflation. The first wave started after COVID. So it's still very early days. But on the positive note, there is huge oversupply in the oil market. And with the UAE leaving OPEC, that is also signaling that you can expect more supply coming from the UAE because they don't have to follow the OPEC quota they normally had to follow. So that also explains, I think, why gold, why oil isn't trading at 150 and is closer to $100. And if you reach the tea leaves well on the negotiations, it's quite clear that both the US and Iran are looking for an off-ramp. Mm-hmm. But the US thinks time is on their side because they say Iran will collapse. They can't continue from a financial and economic point of view without having any exports and any hard assets coming in and hard dollars coming in. But in a way, Iran thinks time is on their side because the longer they blockade exports from the Strait, the more U.S. President Trump is pressured from other countries to reach a settlement. So I think in the end, they both need a settlement. And that's what you can expect. And it will probably be a two-stage settlement. So first you get an end to the blockade, and then they'll start negotiating on all the other dirty details. Mm-hmm.
Willem, what effect do you think that this has on, let's say, the debt markets of countries that are heavily dependent on energy imports? I saw recently that the UK gilts breached their kind of 5% ceiling. Yeah. Do you think that this, you know, we're going to see a lot more of that?
Yeah, great question. I've been tweeting quite a lot in recent weeks and even months that a sovereign debt crisis could be next or will be next. We got some more confirmation of that by Jamie Dimon, the CEO of JP Morgan, warning for a sovereign debt crisis as well. He expects a downturn of the credit markets, and he's warning markets that this will be much more severe than people think. If we look at the rising interest rates worldwide, we're on an uptrend. We've been in a downtrend for over 40 years. Between 1980 and 21, we were in a downtrend. With yields and interest rates. We're in an uptrend since the end of COVID. I think this is being ignored by investors. This is being ignored by the general public. And we, as fund managers, are a bit afraid that one day in the not-too-distant future, markets will start to open their eyes to these risks. And we could see a broader and larger correction, especially now the AI and tech stocks are starting to go down a bit. But there's a lot of downside risk. There's not that much upside risk, although there's an awful lot of money on the sidelines waiting to come back into the market. And with bonds being almost uninvestable for many, well, retail investors and even institutional investors are looking to scale down their bond positions in favor of stock positions. So you can expect a nasty correction in shares, but I think it will be short-lived because central banks will open the floodgates of liquidity, and then in the end you will see a huge rally again. But we have a huge cash position into our fund, and that's for the first time. We've had such a large cash position, so we're defensive.
Yeah, that's kind of what I was wondering is if you see the possibility of another, you know, 2020 or COVID style crash happening when the market has the ability to digest what's actually happening.
If you would look at the markets, the broader markets from a, well, let's say historical point of view, the valuations are sky high, so it would be normal to get an adjustment of 20-30%. This can happen in over a short while, let's say in a shock like we had during the COVID crash, but can also happen over, let's say, 1 or 2 years like we experienced after the collapse of the internet, the tech bubble in at the early 2000s. I remember very well that between March 2020 and March 2003, the tech stocks came down by 70 to 90%, and the broader stock markets came down by over 50%. So it could take a while, but you should expect a broader correction given the high, very high valuations. Mm-hmm. But let me correct, because people often think that we see these high valuation on stocks everywhere. But if you look at our space, the mining space, look at Newmont Mining, you know, free cash flow of $1 billion per month, mm-hmm. License to print money with their business model now. And they have a price earnings ratio of 11, you know. Apple has 25, and in the tech world of tech, they say that's cheap. Well, if 25 is cheap, if Apple is cheap, how cheap is Newmont Mining?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's one of those, you know, dirty industries that digs things out of the ground.
Yeah, but that was, of course, the view of the industry in the last 10 to 15 years. I've got a great example. In the first 15 years of our fund, we started in 2008, we never heard something out of our, let's say, world of government, State Department. But now, in the last 12 to 18 months, they're reaching out every other month. You know, they want to do a brainstorm. They're inviting us to go on trade missions. So I asked them, what has changed? First 15 years, we heard nothing. And then they told us, yeah, well, we always considered mining a dirty business and we weren't allowed to support it. But now we know it's about critical metals, the security of supply. So now we start to support your business. And so now we're your friends. And that's a game changer in the whole, well, Western world. And we see the same in Brussels. We see the same in the U.S., a lot of the red tape is being cut. New mines are being supported and are being opened. And that's great for our business. So we see valuations, which were extremely depressed in our space, are going to a bit more normal level. But as explained, Newmont's a great example. There's much more revaluation to be expected. Mm-hmm.
So do you see it as a... you know, maybe a return to sanity, that we're seeing the growth of the mining industry again, with the recognition that we do still need many of these resources?
Yeah, this morning we had a guy in our office who was interested to invest in our fund. Typically a guy who wouldn't look at mining, he brought an advisor with him, and the advisor told him, you need to look at commodities now. He sold his company. He had quite a bit of money to invest. And when you show him the historical charts, and I told him everything is, of course, is a cycle. And the world of commodities goes from overvaluation to undervaluation. And the last time we had overvaluation, that was 2008. Actually, that was the start of our fund. My worst decision was to start a commodity fund at the top of the last cycle. And I showed him valuation had been coming down for 15 years. And even after 25, we had a gross return of 71%. The valuation is still so low compared to, let's say, the Dow Jones or the S&P. So when you convince people that you had this extreme low valuation still, even after such a great run last year, you can expect a reversal to the mean, and then you get this overshoot. But I'm in the camp that after a bear market of 15 years, which we didn't enjoy that well, but we survived and we always had net inflows, we'll see a bull market which will take decades. So I'm always telling investors, I'm even telling that to the people in our office, you know, don't think this bull market will be a few months or a few quarters like 2016 or 2020. It won't be a few years. I expect this bull market to be a few decades. Because we have the perfect storm now. You have the shortages starting to hit the market. When we look at our supply and demand studies, especially after 2030, the real shortages will start to hit the market in uranium, in silver, or whatever. And then you have the debasement of currencies, which is leading more and more investors are starting to understand you need to protect your net worth to flee to hard assets, to everything the government can't print. And then you have the geopolitical side, you know, the East and the West are starting to compete and starting, you have this bifurcation in the market now. And this is like the perfect storm we've been waiting for. We always expected this to happen. This has been our story for 15 years. We were a bit early in this trade, but now we highly benefit. Mm-hmm.
Well, Willem, one would think that geopolitical turmoil, a new war, oil shocks, energy shocks, that this would be the perfect recipe for gold. Why do you think it has been basically sold off going into and through the war so far?
Okay. I'm old enough to remember each and every crisis since the early 1990s. And if you look back at the charts and go to each and every crisis, whether it's a financial crisis or a war, geopolitical crisis, you always expect gold to move. But the powers that be, let's say on Wall Street, they don't want to send out the signal that gold and silver are the safe haven. So they always sell futures. It's the selling of paper gold and paper silver, which has been documented well enough. I wrote about that in all of my books. And actually, this trick was used in the late 80s to bring the Soviet Union down, because the Soviet Union needed higher commodity prices. And it has been documented that Reagan and Thatcher joined forces to bring commodity prices down using the future markets. So the Soviet Union would have enough hard currency. And that was one of the reasons it collapsed. So that's one part of the story. The other part of the story is we had this wonderful run for gold going from 2,000 to over 5,000 within 2 years. So the market was very vulnerable for at least a technical correction. And actually, you need a technical correction before the next leg up can start. So from a technical perspective, this is great. And gold came down $1,000. The shares came off 20-25%, the gold producers. But actually, gold regained much of that lost ground and came right back to 5,000. I think you can expect a few more of these wiggles. As told, we are defensive. We have a lot of cash. We took a lot of profits. We're still up year to date 7%. And we are waiting until, the fog clears. And I think there's more clarity around the Strait of Hormuz. And you could see the start of a new run for gold and silver. Might have to do with a broader correction in the broader markets, and people start to flee towards gold and silver. So that's our explanation where we are with the price of gold. Mm-hmm.
So when we take all of this together, Willem, does it spell the return of gold for the world, for many governments? Does the decline of the dollar and a new monetary new international monetary architecture kind of go hand in hand with all of this?
Well, as you might know, I'm the author of The Big Reset, The War on Gold and Financial Endgame. And the thesis, I wrote this in 2013, 13 years ago. My thesis was that when the last phase of this dollar-centered world, gold would come back into the system one way or the other. Gold will be revaluated. We would move from a unipolar world to a multipolar world where Russia and China would ask for a bigger piece of the pie. And yesterday, a wonderful study was published by the Deutsche Bank. And actually, if you read that study, it's on my timeline on X. It's just confirmation of that thesis. And the Deutsche Bank, and you can actually conclude that the major banks in the Western world, whether it's Deutsche Bank or JP Morgan or Morgan Stanley, all made a huge turn over the last, let's say, 1 and 2 years. Remember the chief investment officer of Morgan Stanley changing the 60-40 portfolio, 60% in equities, 40% in bonds. Mm-hmm. He changed that to 60-20-20 by halving the 40%, which would be invested into bonds by institutional investors and clients of Morgan Stanley, and now advising their clients to put 20% in gold. That's a move that wouldn't have been possible 10 years ago, because the Wall Street banks were always supporting the strong dollar system. Gold is the anti-dollar, gold is the enemy. But they no longer can ignore what's going on in the gold market. And Deutsche Bank in that report said they expect a further revaluation of gold. I think we've seen the first leg up, but this is not the start. And we had another interesting report today of the World Gold Council. They published their report about Q1 this year. And what they're showing is that central banks keep buying physical gold, keep hoarding physical gold in a massive way. This will be the fifth year that central banks worldwide will buy over 1,000 tons of gold on a yearly basis. That's almost one third of world gold production. And when central banks are fleeing towards gold, well, that's all you need to know. Mm-hmm.
What are some of the nuances to understand in that study that the World Gold Council put out, though? Like, it shows central bank demand being higher, but overall demand and production, I believe, was lower, right?
Yeah, I think the main takeaway for me was that world mine production is down 9%. It's down almost double digit. Well, if you go to university to study economics, the professor will tell you that when the price goes up, supply will go up, because there's a huge incentive to increase production. But although gold doubled over the last, let's say, 2 years, production is down 9%. And that's telling you old mines are being depleted. Not enough new mines have been opened in the last few years. So there's no way we'll see a rise into the production of gold or silver. Peak silver was, I think, 2016. Look at copper. Huge producers for copper like Codelco, state-run company in Chile. They report copper going down double digit. Earlier this week, we had the results for Nornickel, a huge producer in Russia for precious metals. Platinum and palladium production were down 14-15%. So we see declines everywhere. And given the flight to hard assets, given the bifurcation of the market and the fight for commodities by the West and the East, I expect much higher prices, because you need demand destruction, otherwise these markets can't balance. So we're only at the start.
Yeah, it's really interesting to try to consider or to try to parse out why production actually fell. I've been seeing, you know, to your point about silver production peak being in 2016, I've seen a couple reports lately, one from a major bank, another from a couple technical analysts, that they expect $300 an ounce silver this year in 2026. Do you, or how do you see that being a possibility?
Well, I was asked to do a presentation at the VRIC in Vancouver in January, and then in March at PDAC in Toronto. And my speech was actually on this topic. It was titled The Silver Short Squeeze of 25. And I pointed to the fact that if you study the gold-silver ratio and look at the history of the pricing of gold and silver, silver has been trading compared to gold, let's say, 10 to 1, or 1 in 10, if you want to put it that way. So silver is gold is more scarce. You'll find 10 times more silver in the ground than gold. Mm-hmm. And that means that on average, and that's a historical fact, gold is 10 times more valuable than silver. Well, gold is trading at $5,000 pounds, so that means silver could well be trading $500 pounds. And don't forget, this ratio has been valid for hundreds of years, but hundreds of years, silver wasn't the best conductor. We didn't have electricity at that point. Now silver is the best conductor, so we need silver for the industry. So you could even say that the 1 to 10 ratio could well go to the 1 to 5 ratio, because silver is so important for the industry now. You can't build an iPhone without silver. So my target for silver in 21 was always $100 silver. We were trading $20 at that time. That was 5x. We're trading around $100 now. Do 5x, you reach $500. So it sounds insane, but it's just another 5x. Mm-hmm.
You know, in this realm or in this train of thought that mining is being constrained right now, how do you think the higher prices, the higher energy prices are also going to affect miners here, Willem? Margins are fantastic for a lot of miners right now, but you know, higher prices obviously mean a compression of that margin, as well as, you know, for some Australian producers, let's say, inability to get diesel fuel at all. So how do you think that plays into the industry as well?
Well, it's a two-edged sword, and there's a short-term effect and there's a longer-term effect. Short-term prices of the fuel are going up, and energy is often 25-30% of the cost of the mining industry. So the margins are getting squeezed. The gold price is going down, costs are going up. So that explains the correction we've seen in major gold stocks, 20-25%. They came off, but as still Newmont Mining is still highly profitable. The margins are so, well, wonderful that they can easily cope with some higher prices of oil and energy. But imagine that this energy scarcity really gets, starts to hit the Western economies. I can envision that production will go down, or they will slow down production, or let's say go from 3 to 2 shifts. And then you have less output. And what happens when we have less output? Price will go higher. So short term, it's a negative. I think long term, the effects of this new war will be very beneficial for investors in hard assets. Mm-hmm. Because once again, this conflict made clear to investors exactly what happened in the early 70s when we had the first oil crisis and oil shock. You want to have more storage, you want to have more stocks available, because you just have so much risk if you don't have your own national, let's say, supplies. You need to secure your the amount of commodities you need to keep the country and the business running. Mm-hmm.
Willem, with the idea that, you know, the world is being really shown the dependency on oil as, you know, maybe a risk in this case, especially through Asia, Australia, probably a good amount of Europe as well. Do you think this accelerates the shift to nuclear and also renewables?
That's another great question, great point, Tom, because one of the beneficiaries of this crisis will be nuclear, will be uranium. Once again, we have learned that we need to diversify out of fossil fuels. And nuclear energy is one of the main alternatives, and other than wind or solar, it's not dependent on the weather or the climate. It's great baseload energy. So it's no surprise to us. We have 8% of our investments into uranium stocks. It's no surprise to us that uranium stocks are one of the better performers this year. And you can expect another run higher there. We've seen uranium prices going up towards and over $100 per pound. They've been in a correction in the last, 12 to 14 months. I expect a breakout. And when we talk to industry insiders from the uranium industry, I think $150, $200 will be the normal new range. So you can expect a strong rally there. And that's a very interesting, part of the market to be exposed to. Mm-hmm.
Well, and I think on the other side of that, that also contributes to the silver thesis from a solar panel manufacturing as well.
Well, that's what I like about the world of commodities. People often think it's just about gold or gold and silver, but the world of commodities is very broad. You have the energy space, oil and gas, and then you have uranium, which is also in the energy space, but it's trading more like a metal. And then you have the precious metals. And within the precious metals, you have the monetary metals like gold and silver, and then you have platinum and palladium. And then you have the base metals. And base metals were normally, ignored by most investors. But now it turns out most of the base metals are critical metals as well. Nickel is on the critical metal list. Copper is on the critical metal list in the U.S. And so even the base metals are treated like critical metals now, and they have their own supply and demand. So for us as fund managers, you can diversify the portfolio. We used to be very overexposed to gold and silver, but now we just look at what's the most interesting part of the market. Where do we see the strongest uptrends? Lithium has turned the corner. Lithium was always a very small market, was just a sub $10 billion market yearly. There's lithium sales. It's going towards a 50 to 100 billion market now. So the lithium space is getting mature. So there's so many ways you can play the commodity markets. But for retail investors, it's very hard to spot the individual trends and to move in and out ETFs or stocks. And I think that's the benefit for if you run a specialized commodity funds, then you can really play this quite nicely.
Mm-hmm. Well, I was seeing that it looks like lithium is, again, in a supply deficit, much like silver as well, right?
It just started. If you look at the latest market reports, lithium is going into a market deficit, a production deficit. That doesn't mean there's a shortage, because just like silver, all the metals, there are always above the ground stocks available. But normally you can expect the price to start moving up. And if you look at the longer-term supply and demand studies, like I told you before, especially after 2030, most of the metals will see stress in the physical markets. And I think one day within the next 5 to 10 years, you will see real shortages in some of these markets. And that's when the real fun starts from an investor point of view. And of course, it's not good for the world as a whole or the economy as a whole. But shortages for an investor, once there's real shortages and you have the stuff or you have the exposure to companies who own the goods, then you'll do very well. Mm-hmm.
Is it possible that, let's say the lithium story is threatened by new battery chemistry and it would be, maybe more prudent to spread that exposure over, if you see an opportunity in lithium, but also spread that to something like copper, which is going to be necessary regardless of the particular battery chemistry that is going to be used?
Well, we've seen quite some changes in the battery space. Another book I wrote in 2018 was called The Tesla Revolution, which explained all the details on the chemistry on the batteries. Since we published that book, we've seen quite some changes. Cobalt has been outphased for, let's say, 80, 90%. But it's very hard to outphase lithium, because lithium, why is lithium used? It's the lightest metal. And when you need to build a car, you have this huge battery package, and you don't want to have a very heavy car, you need to use lithium. And of course, we can expect more and more changes, and a revolution might be coming from, you know, sodium-based battery. But lithium will be around for a long time. Lithium, there's no shortage in lithium. There's a bit of shortage in lithium production capacity. Lithium is just like rare earth. It's not rare. There's enough to be found, but getting enough lithium supply to the market, that's a bit of a problem. But as a fund, we'll cross that bridge when we come there. For now, supply and demand outlook for lithium looks pretty interesting from an investor point of view. I think the correction is over now. It's an upswing. And we focus, like most of the metals, on the main discoveries, the main projects which still haven't been built. There's some amazing discoveries in Quebec in Canada, Patriot Metals, Q2 Metals. So that's how we position ourselves.
So, Willem, in that vein, is that your, let's say, the target of what you're trying to find is something that has already been proven out that hasn't gone into production yet, that kind of the low spot on the Lassonde curve, if you will?
Yeah, people often ask us who are our peers, who they can compare, what other funds have the same approach. And then I always tell them, I know about five funds worldwide who follow this discovery investing, format. But most of the other peers, they try to predict where a discovery will be. You know, you see that with a fund like Crescat. They shoot with a barrel. They have so many positions, and they hope one or two will make a big discovery. We used to do that in the past, but now we no longer invest, let's say, in the startups. We invest in the scale-ups. We wait till a big discovery has been made. We'll miss the first 100 or 200%, but then there's almost no downside risk. So we prefer to have less positions, have larger positions, and we focus on the top 50 of best and most significant discoveries worldwide, metal agnostic, region agnostic. We don't care what's found. We don't care where it's found, as long as it's big, important, and valuable. Mm-hmm.
Well, managing risk is obviously a big part of running a fund. You mentioned earlier that you guys are sitting on a very large cash position. How else do you think about risk management, especially at a time like this?
Well, we also changed the fund a bit that we used to have long-only exposure. We decided, let's say, 1.5-2 years ago, we wanted to become a bit more defensive. We've seen too many funds go down 70, 80, or even 90% after doing very well in a bull market. So we have a side strategy in which we invest in producers like Newmont, but also Royal Dutch Shell. We're also in oil and gas for, let's say, 8%. And we have some option strategies around those positions. So let's say 30% of our fund is market neutral. They don't go down in a strong correction, or only a few percent. And this side portfolio has done very well for us. And this also helps us to be able to invest much larger sums of money. We always used to be a small boutique fund, let's say 40, 50 million. Now we have 300 million, let's say, Canadian under management. With this strategy, only focusing on the largest discoveries and the best producers with option strategies, we can easily handle $500 million up to $1 billion without any problem. Because for many of our peers and smaller funds, it's very hard to invest $500 million or even $1 billion into the junior mining space because the liquidity is so poor.
Mm-hmm. Well, liquidity is always, I think, a challenge in the junior mining space. But, you know, the ability of a fund to be able to be successful at, let's say, 100 million versus $1 billion, that really changes things, right?
Well, especially study what happened to Pine Tree. Study what happened to Sprott. Even Sprott. Eric Sprott is a private investor now. In 21, his private portfolio was worth 1.5 billion. It came down to 400 million because he was positioning all those illiquid stocks. He's back up to 4 or 5 billion now. But that you can do that as a private investor because he bought all these silver companies. And I think for him, for him personally, it's a great investment style. But you can't do this with other people's money. You know, we've tried that and we made our mistakes. There's this just too much downside risk. And I want to sleep well. I'm 63 now. I hope I can do this another 20 or 30 years, just like Warren Buffett. But I want to sleep well. So I've said here internally in the fund, I don't want to have the risk that we can down 60, 70 or 80%. It's not worth it.
Excellent, Willem. Well, is there anything that you'd like to leave our listeners to think about before we wrap up here?
I think we covered quite a bit. Well, what we haven't discussed is the world as a whole, you know, the politics. If I look what's happening in the U.S., you're almost at a point of civil war today. Trump is tweeting that he's like the new king and puts his photo on a new passport, U.S. passport. And then you have the governor of California reacting and tweeting and making jokes and memes about that. You know, these are some of the highest, well, these are the highest levels of government. And this is such a crazy and dangerous world now, especially with the conflict between the US and China. I think all these wars in Gaza, the Middle East, Ukraine, these are proxy wars of a huge conflict between the US and China, which is still a conflict which is in the first phases. And I'm a bit afraid where this could lead to. You know, you see Europe turning to, let's say, almost a war economy where German factories are starting to produce military hardware. We've seen the same in the US. Ford and General Motors are talking with the White House to start the production of tanks or whatever. This is a very dangerous world. And that's why we choose to become more defensive, quite conservative. But I think there will be huge opportunities, but it won't be easy for investors in the years going forward. I think the easy years are behind us.
Really? You think the easy years of, let's say, stock picking are behind
us? Yeah.
So it proves to be even more important for you to be doing your own research and figuring out the proper places to be.
We had this huge crisis in 2008. And nine. But actually, that was the second crisis. The first crisis was the one when the tech bubble collapsed between 2000 and 2003. So for me, that's the first crisis. Then you have the second crisis after Lehman. I'm a bit afraid that many of these waves come in three. So the third crisis, the third wave, and I think that's what Jamie Dimon is afraid of as well, might be the big one. Mm-hmm. And that might lead to the big monetary reset, as I wrote about in the book. So it's time to get defensive and when you're in the good times, you always think this will go on forever. But then when the crisis hits and hits you hard, you will think, oh, I should have had more cash. I should have been more defensive. I should have taken profit. And that's why my personal portfolio, my model portfolio is always 25% in real estate, 25% physical gold, 25% maximum in stocks, and 25% we keep as liquid as possible, cash or Bitcoin. And this has served me very well. This has served investors very well during a crisis. So diversification is so important. And most investors are overextended. They're for 80% in real estate, or they are for 80% in stocks, or they're 80 or 90% in Bitcoin or crypto. And you will get burned.
Mm-hmm. Well, Willem, for those listeners that want more information from your fund, that's available at cdfund.com. I believe your book is available there too.
Yeah, for free. Well, you can download the book for free, The Big Reset. We're open for all investors, well, worldwide, minimum 50K investment. You can follow me on X, and I think that will do.
Yeah, on X at W Middle Coop and yeah. Substack as well.
Substack, yeah, that's a new, I started the Substack account, and in that Substack account, I use AI to help me write scenarios and analyze markets. And it's almost like an experiment. So everybody's using AI. Most people say they write it all themselves. And what I'm doing is I'm telling the audience, no, this is written by AI and myself, but it's all about good prompting and good editing it's a free account. I don't want to make money. So it's like a nice experiment. And it gives me a possibility to write about markets every, let's say, other week. And that's a better form than writing a new book, which is outdated as soon as it's published.
Yeah. Excellent, Willem. Well, I always appreciate your time and look forward to the next time to speak to you.
Thank you, Tom. Bye.